You're listening to EcoScience, lectures from the 34th Professor Harry Messel International Science School, held at the University of Sydney in July 2007. For more information, go to www.scienceschool.usyd.edu.au.
Can humans just adapt to climate change, or must we continue to work to reduce it? These are some of the issues confronted by Princeton climate expert Dr. Michael Oppenheimer in two lectures delivered in Australia in early July 2007. It was part of the International Science School series. This is How Warm is Too Warm, Part 1.
Thank you for that kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here, not just because I've been in this country before and enjoyed it, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to come back, but also because I am rather interested in what your own views on this problem are. I travel around the world a lot, although I don't get to this part of the world as often as I probably should. So it's a great interest to me, since I hear everybody else's view on the problem, and because I hear my own view echoing in my ears all the time, I like to hear yours also. And I, therefore, am interested in whatever questions you might ask. And if you want to ask questions during the lecture, that's fine. Just raise your hand. If it turns out that I see things running too slowly, I'll ask you to save them for a period at the end. This lecture will be part science, part policy, and part politics. There's a difference between policy and politics, of course. And it really harks back, the title being How Warm is Too Warm, to my own initial attempt to grapple with the global warming problem. It's a huge problem, both as a scientific endeavor and as something that we might ask governments to think about and deal with. And many, when I first got involved in it, many people said, this is 25 years ago, many people had the view that either it couldn't be happening, or if it was happening, it was too big to deal with. And just getting people to understand that there are things that can be done to stem the warming of the Earth is itself a very substantial threshold to try to get over. And as I was first introduced to the problem, after a few years of grappling with it in my own head, someone at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency used the phrase, how warm is too warm? And it struck me as a very useful way to encapsulate the problem itself. Indeed, we seem to be warming the Earth essentially without limit, as long as we pump out the greenhouse gases. So an important, and as we sit here, the greenhouse gases are building up and Earth is continuing to warm. And so it becomes an important question to ask, you know, what is the limit? Is there a limit? Is there some point at which we should ask ourselves, is the warming too much, or when will it become too much? And that is the way I think about the problem, and it helps frame this lecture. And one reason for thinking about the problem that way is because, well, there are other views on how to address issues like this. Governments will frequently say, well, we don't want to talk about limits on a problem like that. It's too big. Why don't we just do our best efforts? And we still see this view abroad, I mean broadly in the world, that maybe with a problem like this, we shouldn't think about what the limits on warming should be, but we should think instead about why don't we do our best efforts to reduce dependence on fossil fuels, for instance. And by the way, I'm very impressed with the TV commercials I see over here in terms of things that individuals can do to deal with greenhouse warming. But if you have any experience with government, you'll quickly find out that if you give government the freedom to sort of do its best efforts, you'll find, and I'm cynical about government, I might add, you'll quickly find that nothing gets done, because politicians are very adept at sort of slithering out from under a problem and assuring them, you know, that they don't have responsibility for having failed to meet any objectives. So they will frequently resist putting up objectives. So as the scientific community has come to think about how to present this problem to governments, the notion that there has to be a frame on it, that we have to sort of say from a scientific point of view, from the point of view of economics, from the point of view of how social systems, societies, groups of people, cities, countries can respond, that we have to come up with some limits to this problem. And that is the driving force behind these two talks. First talk today, we'll discuss how you might go about the business of figuring out how much warming is too much. And the second, tomorrow, we'll go into one aspect of warming, the threat to the great ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, and try to see what that vulnerability, that sensitivity to warming tells us about the answer to this question, how warm is too warm. Now, I'm going to assume you got something from Dr. Perriman's lecture this morning and use that as a basis, so I don't intend to go over much of the details of the greenhouse effect. But I do want to cover a few things that you may have seen already. Certain gases are building up in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide, the main one. These figures are from the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that came out recently. And here we have 10,000 years ago, and here we have today. And we see that greenhouse gases, this is carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, were relatively stable until about 1800 with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and you can see that more clearly in the inset here, which has the last 1,000 years. And then after a small drift up, there was a very rapid rise, which on the 10,000-year scale looks essentially instantaneous, a very rapid rise in the greenhouse gases, which has been tied without any doubt to industrial activity, particularly the burning fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, and to certain other activities, for instance, various agricultural processes, rice cultivation, for instance, produce greenhouse gases as well. So there is no doubt that the greenhouse gases are accumulating, that human beings, the human activities are responsible. However, greenhouse gases have changed naturally and did so long before human beings were on the face of the Earth. And we have evidence of that because scientists go to the center of Greenland and the center of Antarctica, and they drill deep under the ice, and they bring up sections of ice called ice cores. And in those sections are air bubbles. Did Dr. Perriman talk about this morning at all? Okay, so I won't repeat the details. But if we look at the air bubbles and we analyze them, they have samples of the atmosphere as it was 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, now actually 700,000 years ago, virtually unchanged. And that's this blue curve. This is the carbon dioxide levels over time. The black curve are temperatures, which can also be inferred from the properties of the ice at the same levels in the ice core at which the air bubbles are found. By examining the isotope ratios, one can infer what the temperature of the atmosphere was from which the snow fell that formed the ice that we wind up digging up 400,000 years later. It's really a rather remarkable testament to science that that kind of inference can be done successfully. We see that temperature and temperature and carbon dioxide bounced up and down together over time, that they're highly correlated. A correlation or an association does not prove a cause and effect relationship. But in this case, because we know from the physics of the problem, that is the physics of the greenhouse effect, that there ought to be a cause and effect relationship, this kind of data provides a strong supporting demonstration of the reality of the theory of global warming. But that's not the reason I show it to you now. The reason I show it to you there is that because today's carbon dioxide level is here, about 30% above any of the peaks that occurred during so-called interglacial warm periods over the past 400,000 years. So we have already primed the atmosphere for a substantial warming, and indeed, as I think Dr. Perriman probably told you, Earth is already warmed, and scientists have tied that warming particularly of the last 50 years, to the buildup of the greenhouse gases. Let's keep two things in mind from this graph as we go through this talk. One, that today we are at levels here of carbon dioxide which appear to be higher than any in 20 million years. Now, 20 million years ago, this was a much different planet. If we keep building up the carbon dioxide by the end of this century, it is projected the carbon dioxide levels will have reached levels not attained for over 50 million years. 50 million years ago, Earth was a vastly different planet. There were no polar ice sheets. And were that to happen today, sea level would be hundreds of feet higher. So while it's very difficult to project the details over that vast expanse of, you know, climates that occurred over vast expanses of time, and although 50 million years ago there were other things that were different, in addition to the buildup of the levels of greenhouse gases, for instance, the continents were in different positions, it is reasonable to project that those levels of greenhouse gases will cause us some degree of difficulty because they will change the climate in the face of the Earth so radically. I'll point to one other thing. These bumps, as I said, are these peaks are warm periods. We're in a warm period now. These dips are these broad areas of low carbon dioxide correspond to cold periods, glacial ages, when much of the northern hemisphere was covered by ice, which was several kilometers thick. And you can note that there was a warm period, much like today's warm period, about 130,000 years ago. That is called the last interglacial period in the geologic literature, the Eemian period. And it's worth noting that both the Greenland and probably part of the Antarctic ice sheet were much smaller at that time, and sea level was 4 to 6 meters higher. So one way to benchmark the warming problem in terms of big changes is to note that whatever warmth occurred during that period was enough to bring a much higher sea level. And one might consider that one possible limit to warming is to stay away from the warming that would once again bring temperatures that would cause that amount of sea level rise. I'm going to leave that point for the next lecture tomorrow, but keep it in mind. Keep it in the back of your mind. These are probably graphs, again, that you've seen earlier. Global mean temperature has gone up by about 3/4 of a degree Celsius over the last 100 years. The 140 years is approximately the era of accurate thermometer data. Sea level has gone up at the same time. Sea level rises as temperature rises because glaciers melt, because ocean water expands, thermal expansion of a fluid, and because there has been recently discovered a substantial loss from Earth's ice sheets, which have also contributed to the sea level rise. But on the other hand, snow cover is shrinking, particularly in the northern hemisphere, just an indicator that spring is coming earlier and the snow season is coming later. So the season in which the frozen state can survive is shorter and shorter. But there's a broad climate change which has taken place in addition to these sort of simple parameters that are measured routinely. Temperature is higher not just in the atmosphere. It's higher at the ocean surface. It's higher beneath the ocean surface. If you drill a hole in ice, it's higher. There's an indication that the warmth has penetrated below the ice surface. The same thing for the ground. Old oil wells in Canada are the temperature gradient in those wells is studied, and it indicates that the warming is penetrating far below ground. There are more episodes of intense heat. There are less episodes of intense cold. Precipitation has become more intense in most continental areas. That is, rainstorms are more intense. On the other hand, some areas appear to be drying out. I know you've had an extensive drought, an intense drought in this country. It's not the only region where it's happened. It's very hard to tie a particular event like that to the buildup of the greenhouse gases, but it is the case that the current computer climate simulations do project drought in the latitude regions where you're experiencing it here already. Tropical storms, tropical cyclones have become more intense. There's a lively debate in the community about how much of that can be attributed to the buildup of the greenhouse gases, but it's likely that some of it can. The Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets are fraying away at their edges, not uniformly over the whole ice sheets. The ocean is turning gradually more acidic as carbon dioxide dissolves in it, and the general circulation of the atmosphere in some respects has already changed. Furthermore, some of these changes are accelerating. Temperature has risen faster in the last couple of decades than if you look at the century average rate of change, the same thing for sea level rise. So we are in the middle of a comprehensive global change, not just a comprehensive global warming. And the key question, which I'll get to in the second lecture, is the extent to which that change has affected Earth's great ice sheets, Antarctica and Greenland. These ice sheets contain enough ice, were they both to melt completely, to raise sea level, about 70 or 80 meters. That would be clearly catastrophic, and it's not going to happen because this part of Antarctica, which contains 90% of Antarctic ice, probably is safe because long before we warm Earth enough to knock off that part of Antarctica, it's probable that we would have figured out that it's not a smart thing to do, and we will have then instituted policies to restrain the greenhouse gases. I can't promise that that's the course of events, but that's just my own projection. But this part of Antarctica, which contains about enough ice to raise sea level about 5 meters, and the whole of the Greenland ice sheet, it turns out, are vulnerable. They're vulnerable, it appears, to relatively modest warming, although we do not know exactly what the limits are that would bring about loss of those ice sheets, and we don't know how long it would take. We'll discuss that tomorrow. If the situation is so serious, if there's such a pervasive climate change happening already, why has action proven so difficult? And here we get into the matter of policy and politics. And there are some obvious reasons. Fossil fuels are cheap. They're convenient. They're pervasive. You can put a little amount of this stuff in your car, and bam, it explodes and you're off, and you can go as fast as you want to go, and you can go home as far as you want to go, and it's cheap, particularly in the United States. How much does petrol cost here? $1.30 what per what? That's more expensive than it is in my country. I think the United States and Canada are the main offenders in terms of the cheapness of fossil fuels, the inexpensiveness. There are interests related to all parts of this problem. There are people whose livelihood depends on the exploitation of fossil fuels. There are farmers whose livelihood depends on the methods of cultivation they use that produce greenhouse gases. It's not a matter of good and evil. A lot of this is unintentional. It's just the way it is. When you have many diverse interests that need to be, whose attitudes need to be influenced and changed in order for government policies to be introduced to do something about the problem, that problem automatically becomes one that's very difficult to solve. The only way it's solved is with political leadership to sort of tie those interests together and find the commonality. And political leadership, I might say, and this is a personal judgment, certainly not a scientific judgment, has been lacking in many places on this problem. But the science itself is an obstacle to action, because the science of global warming is different. It has different characteristics than the science of most other problems that policymakers are used to dealing with. This is not a traditional political problem to deal with. The scientific fundamentals are unusual. The gases persist in the atmosphere once they're emitted. Some of the carbon dioxide that's coursing through your lungs now as you breathe in search of oxygen was emitted by the first motor vehicle, 100 years old. Some of the carbon dioxide we emit today by burning coal will still be in the atmosphere 30, 100, even 1,000 or more years from now. Actions today entail long-term commitments. It's very difficult for political leaders to deal with. There's a lag between emissions and consequences in both the temperature and the social ability of the social system or the biological system on Earth to respond. That's because the oceans heat slowly, and I think this is probably a point Dr. Pierman made, and the system as a whole physically takes a long time to come to equilibrium. So if we make an emission of greenhouse gases today and we try to ask what the consequences of that emission are, we simply don't know. We have to wait 20, 30, 40, 50 years to see the full consequences. There are very few problems that are quite like that. And again, it makes it very difficult to get political action and to exert political leadership because it means the evidence isn't there. No one can say to you, what you just did destroyed that over there. We don't know because the full consequences are never manifest until there's more gases emitted into the atmosphere. And perhaps most troubling, there is no apparent limit on the problem. And that gives it an open-ended nature. If we were to burn all the coal, oil, and natural gas that's sitting underground, sort of waiting for us to extract and burn, the warming would just, as we burnt that coal, oil, and natural gas up, the warming would continue to increase. There are no bounds on the problem. That in itself makes it, again, difficult for politicians to deal with. So let me go through each of those properties and steps. First, in terms of persistence, probably the easiest way to think about it, although it's a simplification, is to imagine the atmosphere as a bathtub, the emissions of the greenhouse gases as the drip or the flux or the flow from the faucet into the tub, and imagine that the stopper at the bottom of the tub is open, but not very much, so material can move, the water can move out of the tub only slowly. You could tune this system so that you could tune these emissions so that you just maintain a constant level of greenhouse gas concentrations up here. And that is sort of what nature did over long periods of time before humans intervened in the system. The levels of greenhouse gas were more or less constant over periods of centuries, even millennia. Over longer periods of time, shifts in Earth's orbit changed the so-called carbon balance, and that level would go up and down, and that's why we moved in and out of ice ages, as per the graph I showed you earlier. But what human beings have done is turn that faucet up a little bit and increase the drip, and because the rate at which things move out of the tub is so slow, that means that if you do increase this faucet drip, this level will simply increase. So keep that distinction in mind. There's a difference between emissions or flows, and concentrations, which are levels in the bathtub. As we increase the flow, we're going to increase the level. Furthermore, if we want to decrease the level, we have to really turn the flow down. As it turns out, in order to stop the growth in these concentrations, you have to turn the flow in this faucet way down. In order to stabilize the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and eventually keep Earth from warming or halt the warming, one would have to turn that faucet nearly off. It's going to be necessary, if the objective is to stabilize the atmosphere, to make very strong reductions in the emissions of the greenhouse gases. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has looked at this problem also. They have projected warming over this century. And no one has a very good fix on how much emissions would be if governments did nothing about this problem. And that's because, think about it. What determines emissions? Where are these emissions coming from? Anybody have an idea? What are the major sources? Go ahead, tell me. Excuse me? For instance, coal used to do what? Right, coal burning for electricity, for instance. What else? Oil used for what? Petrol drive cars, right. Yes?
Methane
from ruminants. Correct, methane from ruminant animals. Why do we have so many ruminant animals on the face of the Earth now? And what ultimately drives that process? Why do we have so many, population growth, exactly. So this vast expansion in the use of energy, this vast expansion in the human population has driven emissions upward. But, in looking to the future, do you have confidence that you know what emissions are going to be in the future? Do you know, are we going to be driving cars in 100 years, or are we going to have personal levitation devices? If we have personal levitation devices, what is going to be powering them? Carbon dioxide, carbon-based fuel, hydrogen, solar energy? I don't know. So the only way to project the future is to get a bunch of experts in the room and let them guess, essentially, and it's no better than that, a series of guesses. But from those guesses comes a range of potential emissions futures, and from those range of potential emissions comes a range of potential greenhouse gas concentrations in the future, and from those ranges of greenhouse gas concentrations comes ranges of temperature, and that's what this bundle of color is here. So And actually, there's a wider range, which is represented by the bottom of this bar to the top of this bar, so that warming is projected to be somewhere between, I can't even read my own graph here, yeah, between a little more than 1 degree Celsius from today up to somewhere above 6 degrees Celsius, depending on what those emissions are and depending on how sensitive the climate is. And Dr. Pearman talked about some of those uncertainties, I'm sure. But one thing that we know is that no matter what we do, there is going to be more warming, and that's this yellow curve. This yellow curve asks the question, what if we instantaneously stabilize the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? What would happen? What would happen is the temperature would still climb up more than half a degree Celsius. So even with Herculean efforts, which are impossible because one cannot change the fuels that the Earth runs on overnight, we're still going to get more warming. And in fact, most observers believe the best we can do is somewhere in here, and I'll show you that on another graph. The approach, so you might ask, so what do we do about the problem? Well, the approaches fall into three categories, and I'll talk about each of them in turn. Number one, set some technological objective. Let's say we all decided that in 50 years there is no coal burning, there is no oil burning, and the Earth only runs on renewable energy. That's a target that many people have suggested. One possible set of policies would be, let's institute that legally as an objective. Let's make it happen. Then you have to ask yourself how you would go about that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. One could set a politically determined objective. In other words, instead of setting a technology objective, you know, getting off fossil fuels, for instance, one could say, let's cut emissions by a certain percentage every year. And, you know, let's do it according to some judgment about what a reasonable effort would be, what we can afford, how much carbon dioxide, for instance, could be cut without bankrupting the economy. A third way what we could, and that is, that is a program that governments have already adopted in some sense, which I'll show you in a second. A final way to do it would be to answer the question that I posed at the beginning of this lecture. How warm is too warm? What is a sound environmental objective for limiting warming? There is no right answer. There is no one framing for government policy which is the right one. But each of these has advantages and disadvantages. For example, the first one, a technology objective. One could say, as some governments are starting to say, that by 2020, and this is, by the way, a proposed EU policy, it hasn't been approved yet, let's require that all electric power plants have to sequester their carbon dioxide underground. Have people here heard of carbon capture and storage? Okay, so chemically remove carbon dioxide from the power plant stack before it's emitted, inject it underground, and hope that it stays there. We don't know that it stays there, and that's an issue I'll get into in a minute. A technology-based policy, for instance, could provide subsidies to develop research to make that kind of technology cheaper, as we've tried to do, for instance, with nuclear energy. A technology policy could demand that every electric power plant be equipped with one of these carbon dioxide scrubbers. It could give preferential tax treatment for plants that are, or slap extra taxes on plants that are not. There are two problems with it. What happens if we put all our eggs in one basket and we say that's the way we're going to deal with carbon dioxide and coal from electric power plants? What if it doesn't work? What if the carbon dioxide leaks? What if there is no way to store it safely underground? We don't know what the answer to that question is. But if governments go deciding that this is the chosen technology and it turns out it's the wrong technology, you could lose 20 or 30 or 40 years in the effort to restrain carbon dioxide emissions, and with nothing to show for it if the carbon dioxide, you know, leaks out. So a criticism of these technology approaches is that governments are not clairvoyant. They are not good at picking winners. There have been a lot of mistakes made in the energy area when governments thought they were going to be good at picking winners, and so that it's probably not an advisable way to go.
You are listening to Dr. Michael Oppenheimer's lecture, How Warm is Too Warm, Part 1, delivered in Australia in July 2007.
And here's one example. This is the technology history in fuels for the last 150 years. And first, the world was basically dependent on wood in the 19th century. Then coal got to be very substantial, the major fuel source up through them, particularly in industrialized countries, through the early parts of the century. But then the proportion of coal use shrunk as the fluid fuels, oil and natural gas, became important, particularly as transportation motor vehicles spread, and then some contribution from nuclear and hydropower. And more recently, coal has started to make a recovery, in fact, in some industrialized countries, and of course China is heavily coal dependent. So if you think about it this way, if you were sitting in 1850 and tried to project what fuels would be dominant in 1900, could you have done it? Could you have projected this transition? If you were sitting in 1900 and tried to project what fuels would have been important in 1980, could you have guessed right? I would say probably not. But those are the scale of guesses that a technology policy asks governments to make, and I just don't think governments are going to be very good at it. To look at it from in the transportation sector itself, look at what happened. You know, the major transportation, the major way of transportation back earlier than this was walking, basically. But as time went on, we developed advanced technologies like railroads, which became dominant, and then eventually cars, and then air travel started to become important. And if you, again, sat in 1850 and try to project that people would be flying around in 1950 on a routine basis, could you have done it? My great-great-aunt traveled from Germany to New Zealand in 1860, married a gold miner who had come from Australia and settled in New Zealand in the gold rush of the early 1860s. There's a lot of interesting stories related to it. But I spent a lot of, you know, I often wonder what was it like, you know, to sail around the world at that point to try to get to a place like New Zealand or Australia when I just got on a plane and I was here. I mean, it's a remarkable difference. Most people could not have imagined the capability which would be in hand today. And, you know, similarly, even in 1950, we would not have anticipated the great expansion, the amount in commercial aviation. I could not have anticipated, if I'd been thinking about it in 1950, that I'd be able to go to Australia so quickly and so easily. So, that's a scope of thinking that you need to be able to anticipate what the future is going to be like. And if you can't do that, in my view, it makes no sense to try to decide what the appropriate technology is going to be. The second set of approaches pick politically driven, politically determined goals for reducing emissions. That is an approach that was tried with some success in implementation of the Kyoto Protocol. The objectives in the Kyoto Protocol for the EU, an 8% emissions reduction. Of course, the United States and Australia stayed out of the Kyoto Protocol. For, I don't remember, Canada and Japan, I think it's 8%, 6 or 8%. Those goals were strictly politically determined. A bunch of people got in a room, made a negotiation based sort of on what they thought they could afford to do, what would make them look bad if they didn't do it, how to get a process going. There were many, many criteria, but the environmental consequence was not one of them. It's a way to start dealing with a problem. You introduce targets and timetables. You try to get nations to agree on goals. But ultimately, it isn't a way to solve a problem, in my view. It provides an experience. Governments have learned a lot from trying to implement the Kyoto Protocol. There's now an international emissions trading system in place, which some countries are adhering to, other countries are failing to adhere to. In theory, one could learn from the experience, set additional goals, and go back. But the problem is, where are you headed? How much is enough? What'll get you where you want to go if you don't know where you want to go? And that brings me back to that will bring me back again to look at the aspect of the problem that I think is a way to look at it, or should frame the whole thing, namely, what's the environmental outcome? Where do we want to stop the warming? What are the nasty things that could happen that we want to avoid? And then we should work backwards and say, well, what concentrations does that imply? What temperatures does that imply? What concentrations? What emissions? So, and by the way, another reason why these kind of politically driven negotiations are so difficult is that countries had vastly different interests. These are the per capita emissions fairly recently, energy per capita and CO2 per capita. And you can see that, for instance, even though China has recently apparently surpassed the United States in terms of its total emissions, its per capita emissions are still much lower than those in the United States. And these kind of stresses and strains create difficulty in negotiating politically determined targets. So let's go on to the third way, which is, I think, a way which won't be wind up being the totality of the solution, but will provide, I think, the broader framework under which many, many different approaches to reducing greenhouse gases will be carried out. Determine how warm is too warm. What do you want not to happen? What climate changes do you want to stay away from? And set targets for greenhouse gas concentrations to avoid those levels of warming. Then, once you know what the greenhouse gas concentrations you want to avoid are, set levels of emissions to avoid those levels of concentrations. Now, the problem with this approach is that there are a lot of uncertainties. We don't know exactly how sensitive the climate is. We don't know the exact relationship between emissions and concentrations. And we don't know exactly what climate changes would occur from any level of global temperature change in any particular region. So even this way of doing it is not easy. But I think it provides a framework under which you can fit a variety of policies that eventually can bring about at least moving the world in the right direction. And therefore, I think in the end, governments will wind up using all three approaches. I anticipate, because this has already begun, a global discussion on long-term targets. You've heard recently the leaders of the EU, even the leader of the United States at the G8 summit recently, subscribe to a need for a long-term concentration limit. And a discussion has begun of potentially reducing global emissions by anywhere between 50% and 80%. I'm sorry, industrial country emissions by about 50% and 80% over the next 50 years. I think targets will then be set for 10, 20, and 30-year emissions limits, and which sort of are in the spirit of the Kyoto Protocol. And I think, you know, if I were to project forward, that eventually the U.S. and Australia will participate in such target setting. And there will be financial and other regulatory incentives for developing new technologies, but governments will hopefully stay away from trying to pick winners. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, signed at the Earth Summit in 1992, was meant to embody this approach that I've just described. The wording from the convention is rather interesting. The ultimate objective of this convention and any related legal instruments, etc., is the stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at levels that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference, a famous phrase now, with the climate system. And what does dangerous mean? Dangerous means how warm is too warm. It essentially means the title that I use for this lecture. And the Framework Convention went on to point to a few obvious areas where climate changes could be dangerous. Ecosystems could have trouble adapting. Food production could be threatened. Economic development could be problematic. The idea behind the Framework Convention was the one I just outlined. Particular concentration levels would be chosen, which correspond to particular levels of warming. If we decided that 2 degrees was too much warming because it would bring about, for instance, a threat to the ice sheets, as I'll talk about tomorrow, then it would be necessary to restrain concentration somewhere in the 400 to 450 part per million region. That's very difficult, if not impossible. If 3 degrees were thought to be too much, a reasonable level, with anything above being dangerous, then a doubling of carbon dioxide in the 550 range would probably wind up being the target limit, and so forth. Each of these concentration levels implies a big reduction in emissions. This is emissions. These are, at the right-hand side here, we see some emissions trajectories that would correspond to each of these concentration levels. For instance, 550, again, a doubling carbon dioxide, would involve this emissions trajectory for the world. The much more stringent 450 would require this emissions trajectory, with emissions peaking not much above what they are today. In other words, as some people think, it's too late to have that sort of emissions trajectory. So one could actually plot out, if one decided how warm one wanted, if one decided on an acceptable level of warming, one could plot out a bundle of emissions trajectories which would get us there. Another way to look at it is to achieve the IPCC's lowest temperature range, one would need very strong policy. This graph got shifted around a little bit. This is an example, but the EU has proposed a target around here that would require very, very stringent policies for reducing emissions. Others have suggested targets more like this one. But what is dangerous depends on where you live. What we view as dangerous climate change in the United States is perhaps different than what you would view it as down here, and is certainly different from what someone in, say, South Africa would view it as. Furthermore, someone who lives in my country along the coast might view a dangerous climate change entirely differently than someone who lives in Arizona, say. And someone who lives in Melbourne might see it as differently than different than someone who lives in Perth. Where you are, what you do for a living, what kind of life you lead has a lot to do with how you view what an acceptable climate would be. So, for instance, some possibilities for limiting warming would be to avoid a big, large-scale drying at the low latitudes, the sort of thing that this country has had to grapple with recently, avoid loss of certain unique ecosystems, and coral reefs are frequently pointed to because they're very sensitive, avoid an intensification of extreme events like extreme drought, but also like tropical storms or intense rainstorms, avoid abrupt climate changes, as some people have suggested might occur due to a change in the ocean circulation, the meridional overturning circulation of the Atlantic, or avoid a catastrophic sea level rise. If you live inland, you might be less concerned about that. On the other hand, you might be very concerned either way, because if large areas of the world have flooded, that's going to create a problem with moving populations, infrastructure, the economic implications are huge. Let me show you what some of the projections are as far as where we may be headed from a climate point of view. One of the most robust findings of the models that project future climate is a drying at the low to mid-latitudes. That's the brown area here. You can see it does intercept this country. These are changes in precipitation. There are two bands of reduced precipitation projected for later in this century, one down here, the latitudes where you are, and one up there. The drying has direct consequences for food supply and therefore for water, for both drinking, and for irrigating agriculture. And the brightly colored areas are areas with substantial projection of substantial reduction in runoff, that is, water available for actual use. And the blue areas are areas where runoff may increase. The white areas are areas where we're really not sure. And I will point out that the models don't agree for most of Australia. Ecosystems, as I said, coral reefs are frequently pointed to. They're, of course, of great interest in this part of the world. This is a healthy coral reef. This is a coral reef which has suffered bleaching. The color here is from the fish. Otherwise, the coral color has departed from the coral because the symbiotic zooxanthellae have departed from the coral themselves, leaving them without color. And if that happens a few seasons in a row, the coral cannot survive and the reef eventually is destroyed. That process, we're not sure how adaptable coral are, but we're concerned because the process has begun to some extent even here on the Great Barrier Reef. One might say, all right, we want to protect the barrier reef. We want to avoid bleaching being an annual event. What do we do? What's the level of global warming that we get sustained and repeated bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. Extreme events, they may be broadly destructive, while at the same time affecting particular populations in a disproportionate fashion. Heat waves, torrential rainstorms, tropical cyclones are in this category, and we've had some bad episodes lately. This is the record during the famous European heat wave of 2003, where about 40,000 deaths were ascribed to the effect of a relatively intense but relatively brief heat wave. This is the death rate in Europe starting in January 2002 and ending at the end of August 2003. There are natural variations, including a flu epidemic here in the winter of 2003. But then comes this huge spike where the 40,000 people died. If you had asked any of my colleagues at this point how many people could die in a heat wave in an industrialized country, the number would have come out about 1,000. That would have been the best guess. No one had any idea that this was possible. And it should be a chastening experience on the ability of social and natural scientists to project our vulnerability that no one could guess that that actually could happen. It certainly says something about the ability of government to cope with these episodes as they're unfolding, that many people died. Another such episode, you've heard of Hurricane Katrina? I cannot tell you the psychological effect that this has had in the United States. We all knew it was going to happen. New Orleans sits below sea level. Hurricanes strike the Gulf Coast all the time. A big one hit New Orleans 40 years ago and did a lot of damage. And yet, government, not just the national government, but the state government, the local governments, did almost nothing to prepare. And even as the hurricane approached, the government seemed, at all levels, seemed incapable of preparing for the event. And after the hurricane struck and devastated the city, the government seemed incapable of helping the people. And even today, more than two years, 2005, I think. So it's a little less than 2 years. I may be missing a year. Some years after the event, there was still, half the city is gone. It's not there. It's not clear it's ever going to come back. In a big city in a major industrial country, half destroyed, not in wartime. There were precedents from 100 years ago. There are no recent precedents for the United States, at least. Why was government so inept? And what does that tell us about the ability of governments to protect us from global warming in the future? Yes?
Would that be more related to the incompetence of the present government of America?
I don't think it's that simple. I will refrain from comment on my own government, which you can imagine my views on anyway. So, and it gets boring after a while. But I have to say, I think it's a quality of government in general. And I point to the European heat wave. It was a more unusual event than this hurricane. But even as the summer started to grind on and it was obvious something was going on, and even when there are things that can be done, in my country at least, there are plans on how to deal with extremes of heat. What they do is they go around, they identify vulnerable people, and they bring them into shelters that are air-conditioned. The reason this happens is in many places people don't have air conditioning. Even when there had been experiences with heat waves before, the government still did nothing, and it's still not clear even today in Europe that the governments know what to do should this happen again. They're trying, but they're not very good at it. My own view is when unprecedented events happen, generally the response is going to be far, far, far suboptimal. And even when an event which had some precedent and could be predicted to some extent happen, governments aren't very good at dealing with it. So while I think I'm not anti-government, I'm not a libertarian, and I am not an anarchist, certainly. And I believe we need governments to solve the global warming problem. But I think we need to be aware that there is a limitation on the effectiveness of government, and that a lot of that limitation comes in on the adaptation side of the problem. The reason I mention this and go over it again and again is not very long ago, there was a strong school of thought in the climate community that adaptation was a reasonable response. And adaptation is a necessary response, but these sorts of events prove that adaptation will never be a sufficient response. So climate is always going to change if we let it change. There are always going to be new things happening that we cannot have anticipated. And even the ones we've anticipated, we're not very good at dealing with. Was somebody else over here? No? Yes?
I was just wondering how people die from heat wave, like dehydration.
It's very interesting. Some people died from the direct heat exhaustion effect. Most people die from secondary effects. People who are old or sick are vulnerable. And so there's an interaction between several factors, and the heat is one of them. But, you know, the attempts to unfold the heat wave death situation in Europe and try to figure out why particular groups were vulnerable is only just beginning. It's not so simple that only old people died. There was a big heat wave in California last summer, a year ago. And a lot of people who were in their 40s and 50s died because they were doing stupid things like they wanted to continue their bicycling and jogging even as the temperature went up above 110 degrees. So it's a complex situation. There is no simple answer. Many of the deaths, by the way, have to do with interaction with breathing air pollution. Usually when you have a heat wave, the stagnant air, the quality of the air is worse than average. That's another factor. But it's not simple. Okay? So I made my little rant about government there. And having done that, I want to make it clear that, again, we need government policy to solve the problem anyway. This is a rather grim photo. This is New Orleans. One of the more interesting things, a lot of the people, you know, people think about this problem as one of, well, we've got the rich countries and we've got the poor countries. And in the developing countries, they have low adaptive capacity, and it will hit them worse. And I think that's true on the whole. But one should not forget that even in rich countries like mine, we have populations that are not capable of easily adapting to climate extremes. And New Orleans gave a great example. Some of the people who died because they couldn't get in a car and get out of the city in time. And they couldn't get in a car to get out of the city because they're poor and they don't own motor vehicles. And those are the kinds of differential effects, things that fall differently on different groups, that social scientists have only begun to think about, and governments are not thinking about at all. Then there's the issue of abrupt climate change during, as I think Dr. Pierman talked about, during the glacial era. Climate changed, particularly in the northern hemisphere, very fast. You know, in Greenland, changes of the order of 5 to 15 degrees Celsius in a period of 10 years, probably coupled to dynamics of the climate system related to ice sheets. So it's not clear we could have those kinds of rapid changes in the future. But it is a concern. At what rate of warming, at what temperature level, is it possible to bring about such abrupt changes that, again, adaptation would be difficult? And the aspect of the climate system that's most often pointed to in this regard is the meridional overturning circulation or the thermohaline circulation, which transports heat, water, and salt from the equatorial regions to the North Atlantic where it sinks. It's a driver of many aspects of the climate system, and it's thought to be one of the key forces which cause these abrupt climate changes during the ice ages. We don't know how sensitive this circulation is. The current thinking is abrupt climate changes will not happen in the range of projected warming that we see for this century, but we honestly don't know for sure. Next time, I'm going to deal with the sea level rise problem. This is my favorite picture of sea level rise. I don't know if you know much about sea level. I don't know if you know much about the United States, but Princeton University is in the state of New Jersey. This is one of the higher concentrations of urban development in the state of New Jersey. It's called Atlantic City. You probably heard of Las Vegas, but you probably haven't heard of Atlantic City. It's a spin-off gambling empire. You know, these are hotels where people come to gamble. And the thing that always strikes me about this is they built this. It's on a barrier island, a strip of sand. There's no place where that sand is more than a few feet above sea level. Billions and billions of dollars of infrastructure are stuck down there. The wetlands in the back, which you can sort of barely see, which were once thriving nurseries for what's called the Delaware Bay Estuary, have been encroached upon and largely destroyed. You can see they put an airport. It's typical, put it in a wetland. We do that all over the place. And, you know, some of the projections of sea level rise, you know, are just going to overwash this thing. And this is nothing new. This has been known. Yet in the face of this potential, of a large climate change and a large sea level rise, we just keep building and building and building. Well, this is the way my country handles adaptation to climate change. I don't know what you guys do here. So I want to leave this lecture on that note. We'll pick up tomorrow and ask, you know, so what do we, you know, what do we do about sea level rise? In my view, sea level rise is probably the most globally pervasive aspect of this problem, perhaps matched to some extent by the anticipated drying that I talked about. And in my view, the most sensitive part of the system is probably the sea level aspect. It's where the biggest damages probably would occur. And the sensitivity of the ice sheets and their contribution to sea level, I think, ultimately provides a very good way to anchor policies on climate change and tell us really how warm is too warm. We'll leave that for tomorrow. Leaves us for 20 minutes of questions for today.
That was Dr. Michael Oppenheimer in Australia in July of 2007 as part of the International Science School series. Part 2 of the speech, How Warm is Too Warm, is available from the Radio EcoShock climate pages at ecoshock.org and from the Science School at scienceschool.usyd.edu.au/podcast. I'll give that to you again, scienceschool.usyd.edu.au/podcast. That's for the whole series.